Hello and welcome back to Mr. Jeffrey On's World History Podcast. It's episode 32. Can you believe it? They haven't canceled us yet. Today we will discuss 19th century European imperialism, the building of global empires. If you have any questions, feel free to call the Google Voice number 321-804-APWH, or if you would rather, you can also send an email to mrjeffreyon@gmail.com. Let's begin. Empire building is a very old, largely reoccurring aspect of world history. We see it intensify during the Classical Age with the Persians, Macedonians, and Romans, and it continues all the way into the modern era. What sets aside the imperialism that will be discussed during this podcast from more ancient forms previously discussed includes the fact that colonial powers were able to hold much more power than ever before. The technologies and advances in warfare that made 19th century imperialism possible, and the impact imperialism had on the economic and political geography of the world. The greatest difference that sets 19th century imperialism apart from the empire building of the Classical Age can be found in one word: global. Empires were no longer simply land-based, and countries as small as Great Britain could now capture amounts of territory 100 times its size. One definition of global, as found in the Encarta Dictionary, is taking all the different aspects of a situation into account. To understand the modern form of imperialism, as seen through the mid to late 19th centuries to the early 20th century, you really do have to take all the different aspects of the situation into account. Other imperial forces, the increasingly complex global economy, diverse array of motives, political and social ideologies all come into play. Now that we hopefully have a better understanding of the nature of the imperialism being discussed, let's talk about what exactly were the new motives for this boom in expansion and colonization. Well, due to the Industrial Revolution, there was a surge in economic activity throughout the world. Entrepreneurs could now make personal fortunes, but sometimes they needed access to new markets and new territory. So companies and individuals would go out and try to find a place or territory that they could control and extract profits from it. An example of this would be a British businessman who, during the early 19th century, wanted to make his way in the booming cotton textile industry. He wanted access to the cotton market directly so he could get the cotton for the cheapest price, and to get a lot of it as well. So he might establish a cotton plantation in India. Now he controls a valuable trade route between Britain and India, while also increasing European control and influence on a foreign country. Replace this man with a trading company or joint stock company, and you have a very common example of how many areas became colonized. Another motive for imperialism at this time was more political in nature. Countries wanted to extend their influence on foreign nations and gain control of strategic areas, especially ports and harbors that would allow their country to take in more revenue, and therefore making said country more powerful. As you may have already figured out, political and economic motives often went hand in hand. However, some political motives were not always purely economic. Sometimes they were to diffuse internal tensions within countries that perhaps were becoming too overpopulated. These countries needed more territory to place their disputing populations. Picture a small apartment with a family of eight living inside, and all eight members disagree terribly about many things. One sibling complains the other is always bothering them, dad is always tripping over shoes someone left in the doorway, and mom just wants to watch her favorite TV show in peace. Something that might help the situation for this family is to buy a bigger house. A house big enough where the conflicting members of the family have more space between one another and are not always on top of each other. Buy a bigger house and the potential for getting into fights decreases. Regardless of the motivation, the devastation inflicted on a country by an imperialistic power was often justified by racism and the new idea of social Darwinism. One poem that really shows the nature of the reasoning behind all the new forms of imperialism was Rudyard Kipling's poem, White Man's Burden. At the time, it was thought to be the white man's burden to spread Western culture and civilization to the rest of the, quote, uncivilized people and nations of the world. This highlights the concept of social Darwinism, whose proponents believe that, evolutionarily speaking, those of European descent were better, more intelligent, and capable than those of other races, and therefore it simply made sense that they should take over what they believe to be their inferior brethren. For an in-depth look at why European culture came to dominate the globe from more of a human geography standpoint and not a racist bigot standpoint, check out either the book or the National Geographic special Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. The 3-episode series can be found on YouTube. So, let's cover exactly who was imperializing whom. Great Britain started its actual rule of India from the state itself under Queen Victoria in 1858. But long before that, the English East India Company had taken advantage of the Mughal Empire's decline and built large trading cities such as Calcutta and Bombay. The main reason for the rule switching from the company to the crown itself was a little debacle called the Sepoy Rebellion. Sepoys were Indian troops controlled by the British, who had to endure very harsh treatment. After becoming fed up with their mistreatment, they rose up and actually killed British civilians. And as you might expect, the British did not take that too well. After the Crown took over India in 1858, a British civil service ruled over viceroys in India. Indians could obtain the lower-level government positions. However, unlike many of their counterparts, such as the French, Great Britain really did not do all that much to interfere with the traditional Hindu religion and culture, except for outlawing customs that they considered offensive, such as sati. Britain was also involved in another imperial venture nicknamed the Great Game. This was a contest between Britain and Russia over Central and Southeast Asia. If the winner was determined by who gathered the most amount of land within these regions, Russia, in general, won the game. This does not mean Russia was more powerful. Russia's success is probably more likely due to the fact that Britain was preoccupied with other things like India and Africa. The Dutch took control of Indonesia, which allowed them greater access to the spice trade. The French colonized Indochina, which consisted of Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. They were very different from the British as far as how the British ruled India, in that the French encouraged conversion to Christianity. The Kingdom of Siam, modern-day Thailand, existed as a buffer state between Burma and Indochina to prevent the European powers, the British and the French, from going to war. Another very important example of colonization we must absolutely discuss is termed the Scramble for Africa. This was Europe's attempt to seize the entire continent of Africa for its own economic and political gain. European colonies had already formed in Africa. To avoid any potential for argument and dispute, the Berlin Conference was held. This conference set the rules for colonizing Africa, essentially carving the continent up like a Thanksgiving turkey. One of the biggest rules set forth was the idea that occupation established authority in a colony for a country. So pretty much if you had settlers, or rather a military, occupying an area, the territory or state was yours. One of the earliest examples of colonization in Africa were Dutch farmers called Afrikaners settling in South Africa. This led to many events, including the Boer Wars, which were territory disputes in South Africa between the British and the Dutch. The conflict between the British and the Dutch had already led to the migration of the Afrikaners inland, nicknamed the Great Trek. They even created their own Creole language, which was a mix of Dutch and native African languages. But it wasn't just the British and Dutch colonizing Africa. Italy, Germany, France, Belgium, Spain, and the Portuguese all participated. When it came to actually governing over the newly acquired lands in Africa, there were two overall methods. One was indirect rule, the example being the British, and the other was direct rule, a method practiced by the French. Indirect rule consisted of governing through already in place local governing systems, which the British practiced in India as well. This really only worked in societies that were highly organized, and the majority of African society at the time were dispersed with social structures based on kinship groups. They didn't have what Europeans might have seen as governing systems. This actually led to indirect rule establishing firm tribal boundaries, even where none existed, which created problems between the tribal African societies and the European societies who wished to rule them. Direct rule, on the other hand, replaced indigenous institutions with European systems of governing and European rulers. This required a lot of personnel, so this method of established control was often more costly than indirect rule. A, quote, civilizing mission is often how direct rule was justified, a justification that was needed because of the strict rule and extreme change it put upon the native populations. One can see the impact that all of this dividing and conquering had on the African populations, as many tribes lost their identity and way of life, a problem still plaguing much of Africa to this day. The scramble for Africa did just that. It left Africa scrambled. In addition to the traditional European powers, new countries were tossing their imperialistic hats into the ring, the most successful examples being the United States and Japan. Let's begin with the United States. Ever since the Industrial Revolution made its way to the U.S., the United States had been on its way to becoming a major player in the world economy. In 1823, James Monroe put forth the Monroe Doctrine, which practically established American dominance over the entire Western Hemisphere. The doctrine opposed any countries from Europe to set forth on imperialistic ventures in America. This wasn't really to protect the states of Latin America, but more to protect the United States' own practical monopoly over American trade. The United States was also expanding territorially. Alaska was purchased from Russia and became a state. Alaska was purchased from Russia in 1867, and Hawaii was taken over, due in part to the Dole Pineapple Company, in 1898. Another important factor that increased America's share in empire building was the Spanish-American War. The Americans won the war, which led to the annexation of Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines, and the occupation of Cuba. The construction of the Panama Canal, completed in 1914, led to increased access to the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and made trading a whole lot easier. Japan, on the other hand, was potentially rivaling the United States for Rookie Imperial Power of the Century Award. If such an award did exist, the United States would have had the edge because it really wasn't until the beginning of the 20th century, after the end of the Russo-Japanese War, that Japan firmly established itself as an imperial power. However, during the 19th century, Japan was making large territorial gains, starting out with annexing nearby islands, which still make up the modern state of Japan. After the victorious outcome of the Sino-Japanese War, the Japanese established power over former Chinese tribute states, Korea, Taiwan, Pescadores Islands, and Liaodong Peninsula. This was all largely due to the Meiji Restoration and the focus on industrialization, which strongly enhanced Japan's military, especially their naval power. One possible motivation for Japan to establish itself as a military and imperial power might be the humiliating unequal treaties forced upon it when the United States opened it up to trade in the 1860s. Unequal treaties that were strikingly similar to the treaties forced upon the Korean people by the Japanese in the early 20th century. So, the new imperialism, the global imperialism of the late 19th century and early 20th century, had many repercussions. First, it led to increased nationalism among the subject peoples under the control of European imperial authority, the heavy impact of which will be seen in two global world wars to come. It changed what many produced as crops. Many colonial economies now could only afford to produce cash crops, which were sold to the imperial powers. That had a major impact on the traditional lives of many societies, especially those in Africa, and also those in India. More people were growing cotton than food. If there was a drought, if there was a food shortage, that led to starvation, that led to people dying. The new imperialism created massive labor migrations from continent to continent, as the new industrial powers were driven to economic success through vast amounts of cheap labor, often provided by indentured servants. It led to increasing racism and the concept of social Darwinism and harsh stereotypes among those with non-European descent. The British presence in India led to the creation of the Indian National Congress, which paved the way for independence and government from within. So make sure to follow the many connections you see during this time period with previous ones and ones to come, as history does not occur in a vacuum, but flows continuously between a web of interconnected actions and events, with many occurring simultaneously. That wraps up today's episode. Until next time, this has been Mr. Jeffreyon's World History Podcast.